So I wanted to go back to the front page here, and I have throughout the presentation some pictures of the women and children in the house, and rest assured that I do have IRB approval and, of course, the consent of the participants to show these pictures. And I think that they really help illuminate this very underserved and often isolated population. So I'm going to be presenting today our ethnographic evaluation of an ATI, it's an alternative to incarceration, program for women charged with felonies. It's in Brooklyn. I'm so happy to be here representing New York today, the city that just will not quit, and to be here with you. So I have no disclosures. And I want to acknowledge my co-investigator and very long-time mentor, Dr. Byrne, in the audience. And she's the PI in the prison nursery work. So. I also want to acknowledge our research participants. I don't know if any of you have ever done ethnography, but it's a very intense research methodology. You spend a lot of time with participants, and they shared their lives, their apartments, their families with me in an amazing way. Also, the study was funded by the Center for Homelessness Prevention Studies at Mailman and at School of Public Health and the New York Women's Foundation. So with the great rise that we've seen in incarceration over the past 30 years and with the war on drugs and everything, we've seen also a great rise in the intergenerational effects of incarceration. You see here that approximately 150,000 children on any given day in 2007 had a mom who was imprisoned. And it's about the same now. These rates are really stabilizing. But they're stabilizing at these very artificially high rates. I'm focusing today on incarcerated women or women involved in the criminal justice system, though I do want to say that the criminal justice system does, it's mostly men in the criminal justice system. When you're looking at the parenting piece, though, about 60% of women who are incarcerated say that they have a child, and they're more likely than criminal justice-involved men to have been the caregiver of their child before they were incarcerated, and to say that they have a plan or they want to parent their child after they get out. So when we look at the health and social effects of incarceration, I mean, it's unbelievable, the disparities in this population. So for incarcerated women in particular, when you compare them to their male counterparts who are also criminal justice involved, or you compare them to community women, there are gross disparities in medical, mental health, substance abuse, and histories of victimization, and also almost all of the social indicators that you would want to pick out, including residential instability up to and including homelessness, and unemployment and poverty. The reentry period for women in particular is marked by residential instability and a real struggle to meet basic needs. And then when you look at people's children, so the intergenerational component here, the children of incarcerated women show disparities in early attachment and security, which we know has long-term implications. Disparities in behavior problems, academic failure, and then are more likely to have their own criminal justice involvement. And with all the work that's come out about ACEs, this amazing body of literature on adverse childhood experiences, the incarceration of anyone in a child's home is an adverse childhood experience. And we know also that incarceration is linked to other adverse childhood experiences like maternal substance use, maternal mental illness. So all those things just really working together to create long-lasting increased risk for morbidity and even mortality in these children. So what are some of the interventions to support families when a mom is involved in the criminal justice system? A lot of places now have supported visitation. I should step back. Visitation can be seen as a spectrum, right? You can provide visitation. You can provide visitation where people actually get to touch each other versus, you know, through plexiglass. You could provide visitation in supportive environments where the children come into a room that's more friendly than a regular visitation area. And you can even have people, case managers, working with the children before and after. So this visitation looks a lot of different ways. But you can tell, you know, you can see visitation may not work for a very, very young child in establishing that initial relationship that's needed to support secure attachment. There are also prison nurseries in 8 states. So I'll show you here. So all the green states have a prison nursery. But all the black states, a woman who is pregnant and gives birth while she's incarcerated is almost immediately separated from her child. And so the general eligibility criteria for prison nurseries is that a woman is pregnant upon admission, convicted of a nonviolent crime, have an expected release date 12 to 18 months after the due date, and have no history of crimes against children. So you can imagine with that pretty strict eligibility criteria, just with the age alone, you're like, you know, there's so many people who are excluded from these programs. Having said that, for the women who are able to get into these programs, Dr. Byrne has, her study has been going on since 2001, to look at the long-term outcomes, and we've found really positive findings for infant outcomes inside, for toddler and preschool outcomes outside, and positive effects for the women as well. So for the women that these programs do serve, they do have positive outcomes. So there's increased interest with the recession and cost and looking at criminal justice in a different way of alternative programs, some of which are these maternal mother-child community corrections programs that allow women to be diverted from the system and stay in the community with their kids. So the thing about that is there's like less than zero information about these programs, their availability across the country, who's eligible, who's using the program, the models that they're using, the outcomes for the families and the women, the children, everyone. These can come in locked and unlocked variations. So there's a wide difference in the program models. Some of the models, a woman has to go inside for a little bit in due time and then come out and be reunited, and you can imagine that's a problem. And some are pure diversion models where there's really, women don't have to do, don't have to be separated, potentially separated from their kids. So one of these potential models could be supportive housing. And what supportive housing is providing housing for people and then providing supports. So mostly it's case management within the home to families, generally homeless families. So the question of could supportive housing be used as an alternative to incarceration in this population without harming public safety? Because you always have to keep that in mind. So what has been found is that supportive housing reduces incarceration days and improves residential stability for mostly men who are frequent cyclers between jails and shelters. So these are your chronically, seriously mentally ill, chemically abusing population. But also supportive housing has been shown to promote preservation, reunification, and residential stability in homeless families involved in child welfare. So this intervention is working really well with these serious multi-problem populations. Could it work for this population too? So Drew House was developed by a team of DAs in Brooklyn, New York. Go Brooklyn. And our DA in Brooklyn is an activist DA. He's really strongly supportive of alternative programs. And he worked together with a homelessness services provider, his team of DAs, and I have to mention them, Terry Faby in particular, amazing woman who was instrumental in giving him the idea and working to make sure that this happened. So to put together this supportive housing alternative to incarceration, it's non-secure. The women, it's like a row house. The women and children all have their own apartment unlocked. They do have curfews, but there's no correctional staff on site. It's very similar to, if you've ever worked in a supportive housing site, it looks like regular supportive housing. It serves women with felony charges. So these aren't women who are cherry-picked with misdemeanors. These are women potentially facing serious upstate prison time. And it does not exclude women with violent offenses, which is extremely unusual. And what they do at the DA level to, you know, as they're figuring out where to go with cases, they say, does this woman have a history of violence? Does it appear that, you know, she uses violence as a strategy, that she's going to be at risk of using violence again? And so if the woman kind of meets those criteria, they go and ask the victim, if we offered this program, would you be okay if we offered this alternative to this family? And of the women who they picked out for the program and asked the victim, all of the victims have said, yes, we really want this family to have a chance. So The services provided on site are case management and some counseling, and they refer for all other services, including health care. So there's not an NP or anyone who comes in and provides any type of health care. They accept up to 3 minor children per family. There are no age restrictions, which is very unusual. Most programs restrict children under 3, the community programs, and only usually you can only bring 1 child, which you can imagine that choice, right? And tenancy can continue after the completion of the court mandate, which is also unusual, and is wonderful, but can also create some challenges, which we'll talk about later. So this is a quote from DA Hines, and I have a number of quotes. That there's a lot more to public safety than just locking people up. So that was his thinking. And he actually named the program after his own mom. Her maiden name was Drew. So very personally committed to this program. So the primary study aims today are to describe the health and social histories, the strengths and needs, and the interim outcomes of the entire initial cohort of women and children who resided in Drew House, this innovative ATI program, and to explore the culture of Drew House through personal and shared experience of the resident, the staff, and the program developers. We used ethnographic methods. This is a very small program so far. So we felt that because the program brings women together to live and create a community, that ethnographic methods really fit the project well. We collected data between January and September of last year, so this is really fresh, pretty fresh data. The sample were all current and former tenants, except for one, and we'll talk about her in a minute. So 8 women and their 12 children, 3 staff, 1 administrator, and the whole team of Kings County DAs that made this happen. Data collection was in-depth interviews consistent with the methodology. I also did participant observation in the home at least once a week for about 8 hours a week for 7 months. So I was really a fly on the wall there for a long, long, long time. And data analysis consistent with ethnography was concurrent with data collection. And we used a strategic ethnographic approach. There were a couple of domains we were interested in particular, and I'll show you those in a minute. Because you know with ethnography, you collect data on so much stuff. And so we really pared it down to the things that we were interested in and the things that our community partners were interested in. Of course, we had IRB approval, and we also had a certificate of confidentiality because the women were under criminal justice mandates. So just to describe the characteristics of the women, they were about 29 years old, but there was a wide age range, that women, 20-year-old women to 40. The charges were across the map to felony weight drugs, property charges, weapons possession, which carries mandatory sentencing in New York. It's a big deal. Robbery, assault, and reckless endangerment. So all of the women, consistent with the literature in this area, had histories of residential instability up to and including homelessness, domestic violence victimization, substance use, mental illness, and family separation from their own primary families, but also from their children. And the children, the women had a mean of an average of 2 children, but as far as the children that lived with them, an average of 1 child actually was brought into the program. But some women brought up to 3 children into the program. The mean age of the resident children was 5 years versus the non-resident children was 12 years. So this program wasn't serving so much the women's older children who, for the most part, and I'll talk about this in a minute, chose to stay in long-term caregiving arrangements that they had already been in. So the children, consistent with the literature too, had chronic unmet health needs, limited or inappropriate use of health services, extensive exposure to ACEs, and because you see up here, the mothers are being victimized often in front of the children in the history, substance use and mental illness, those are ACEs and the children were exposed to them. And so a very vulnerable group of family. So one of the domains that we were looking at was family preservation, family outcomes. Something that came out loud and clear in every interview that we did with the women is typified by this quote. This is an opportunity that I was granted just to stay with my kids. I couldn't ask for anything more. I'm trying to finish my mandate. You learn from your mistakes and you keep going forward. So this sense of this being an opportunity and a sense of, okay, this is this shot that I was given to move forward in my life, this process of moving forward. The program allowed women to remain or reunite with their youngest children, The older children stayed in long-term caregiving arrangements. But the women were in contact with those children, close contact. They could come into the house and spend the night with their brothers and sisters. The women could go at some point in the program when they were, you know, kind of checked off and they had met all the requirements. They could go and stay wherever that child was living if the relationship was okay with the caregiver, and usually it was. So that almost all of the women in the house had history of child welfare involvement. And those were all progressing successfully. And the child welfare system really looked at this program very positively. There was a feeling that these cases were progressing faster than they would have because of them being in this secure setting. However, having said all that, there was a lack of programming and staff expertise to support child health and the parent-child relationship despite these great needs. And the program really seemed to focus on just housing families together. So for housing stability, the families remained stably housed both during the time that they were there and after. Some of the women had moved out, and I did go and interview them or speak to them at length on the phone. Everyone described Drew House as their home, which for Dr. Byrne and I, for you know, people who worked on this prison nursery, no one in that study said that the prison nursery was their home. And some of them lived with the children for like 18 months inside, you know, their baby. So these women said, it's not even time I'm doing, it's not time because as you can see, this is my home. They gave us our space, we had our own apartments, we had rules. I didn't really care, I was with my daughter, it was homey, it was my home. And that was like over and over and over. And there was even ambivalence towards moving out of this place, even though it was, you know, you had curfews, that you were there under a mandate. The women felt so safe and so secure there, and they had formed a community, and they were very ambivalent about leaving that. So for the criminal justice piece, it was important to our partners. And also, we know with criminal justice, it has serious health outcomes, so we looked at that. There was only one disciplinary discharge from the program, and that was because of repeated rule violations. So it wasn't that, you know, a violent woman came into the house and she was violent with the children or the women. She just couldn't come in on time, and she was trying to bring her boyfriend in very late at night, and it triggered the other women who were very upset about her behavior and, you know, that she was getting over and getting away with things. And so she was removed. She wasn't found until this month, actually. She came in on a bench warrant and is going to be referred to residential substance abuse treatment. I just found that out last week. So we felt like the strong staffing and strength-based gender-responsive model really created the calm environment in the house and supported assistance. So of the two staff in the house, one did 13 years of prison time as well, so she really understood this population. She's also has a bachelor's in social work and is studying for a master's, so she has that clinical piece as well. And another, the other staffer what came in through the homelessness services organization as a tenant at first and was groomed to work with the and trained to work with the women. However, having said that, there was a real lack of coordination and communication between all of the systems that that work together to either help or hurt these women. So the courts, the mental health, substance abuse providers, a lot of that communication fell down. So these are some, this is a quote, I'll read one of them. The medication that I was taking, they didn't approve of because of my toxicology. So what her psychiatrist prescribed a benzodiazepine and it popped up on her drug screen. So right now, you know, like I'm not seeing a doctor and I'm not under medication. I've been off meds for quite a while. And this woman is bipolar and was really in need of psychiatric care, obviously. And another woman stopped her her methadone maintenance therapy because of all the issues of communication. So the results that we found so far, and this is obviously preliminary and it's a very small program, was that allowing these select women charged with felonies and their families to reside in this program strengthened the families without compromising public safety. And that the organizational culture that had been set up supported desistance from criminal activity and the completion of court mandates, but it left a lot of needs in the areas, especially of child health and the parent-child relationship, and that interagency communication challenges created stress and threatened the positive gains that this program could have on these women. And we know as nurses that communication challenges are always a struggle in, you know, transition and in complex organizations, you know, people in critical care, handing them to long-term care, handing them to rehab. But in these cases, communication challenges could lead to serious upstate prison time for these women. So this is something we really have to work on and get right. So The implications are legion, but just a couple of them that we should, you know, these programs should be expanded and replicated. And in the expansion and replication, they need to be better supported. And from a public health nursing perspective, I see a role for us in these community corrections programs to provide interventions to support family relational and health needs to assist with that coordination, which we as nurses are so good at. And of course, further descriptive and interventional research needs to be done to make sure that what we do is good and you know, to find out how we can do it better. So I would love to talk to anyone more about this. Please feel free to email me.
Thank you. We'll take questions after.
Sure.